From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. How do you see the excess in modern society? Well, photographer Chris Jordan turns statistics into art. He's done a photo that looks from a distance like a pile of derelict cars in a junkyard. Actually, the composition comes from 260,000 car keys, equal to the number of gallons of gasoline burned in motor vehicles in the U.S. every minute. Another of Chris Jordan's photos is called Over the Moon. It looks like a moonscape when you stand back, but it's composed of 29,000 credit cards, equal to the average number of personal bankruptcy filings every week in the United States. His photo, Barbie Dolls, looks from the distance like a topless woman's torso. It is 32,000 Barbie dolls, equal to the number of elective breast augmentation surgeries performed monthly in the U.S. in 2006. Chris Jordan is with us to talk about his work. And I know it's frustrating to talk about art without being able to see it, and we can't do that for you on the radio, but ChrisJordan.com has some great galleries where you can take a look at the work we're talking about if you have not had the opportunity to see his work before. Chris Jordan was a corporate lawyer for 10 years before becoming a photographer, and he makes his home right here in Seattle. Now, I've heard you say that when you began as a photographer, you weren't that interested in consumerism. It was color, it was composition and what you were shooting that got you interested. Why did you come to adopt that as a theme of your work?
Well, it's an issue I'd been interested in for many, many years. My dad introduced me to the topic back when I was in high school. He gave me the book Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman, and that's sort of like taking, you know, the blue pill. Mm-hmm. And I'd been photographing, and my interest in mass consumption and my interest in photography were these two parallel things that never met. And so I've been doing photographic work for, I don't know, something like 25 years. And always searching for a relevant topic. You know, I was doing this kind of really personal work that's just about beauty, and I always had a sense that it wasn't relevant, and I wanted to find a relevant topic. And it was actually the photographic process itself that taught me, you know, rather than me going out and trying to find big piles of garbage because I wanted to understand mass consumption, those subjects came to me as objects of beauty. And it was only after talking with friends who saw that work, they said, hey, by the way, Chris, this is beautiful, but it's also a macabre portrait of America.
So you saw it as beauty, and then they kind of drew to your attention there was this other theme to it, which led you to it.
Mm-hmm.
When was the first time you actually felt as though there's one thing to have an idea in mind and a theme that you want to bring across, then there's actually making it happen? I mean, were you able to do that instantly? Did it take you a while to your satisfaction to take a photograph that you thought brought those two pieces together?
Mm. Well, it was a process that evolved over a long time. And my first photographic project that was about mass consumption, it was a project that I call Intolerable Beauty. And that was a series of straight photographs that weren't digitally manipulated the way a lot of my current work is. And if I look back on the chronology, the first, I don't know, 20 or 30 of those look like they're more about color than they really are about mass consumption. And so there are pictures of the sides of train boxcars, you know, that are just lots of really beautiful color, or big stacks of shipping containers. And once I became more intentional about going looking for piles of our garbage as a commentary on mass consumption, then the aesthetic changes a little. Like, mm-hmm. I sort of became willing to go into a more dark aesthetic place, and some of those later images start looking a little more grotesque.
And in fact, listeners, if they go to ChrisJordan.com, there's a photo you took, I think, in 2004 in Tacoma, and it's a pile of junk cars. I think it's pretty straightforward. But then, as I described just a few moments ago, you took that same theme, a pile of junk cars, and made more out of it, right?
Well, yeah. As I was photographing all those years, I kept running into this wall where, you know, I would go to a place and see maybe 200 junked cars, or I'd go to a cell phone processing facility and see 3,000 or 4,000 cell phones. And that's the most I could ever lay my hands on. Because there isn't like a Grand Canyon of our garbage where it all goes.
Except so, in your photos.
Well, that's what I wanted to create is the visual impact of that.
Yeah.
Because there is no such place. And so the cumulative effects of our mass consumption are invisible. And the only information we have to try to comprehend the enormity of what we're doing collectively is these giant statistical numbers that are totally incomprehensible to our minds. And I imagine if there were a Mount Everest-sized pile of all of the cars we throw out every year, or all the laptop computers that are being discarded in the world every year. If we could go actually stand in front of that and behold it, it would be mind-blowing, and we'd be so shocked that we'd change our behavior. But instead, all we have is these numbers, 210 billion plastic bottles used in the United States last year. We can't possibly comprehend that, and it doesn't really register, you know, as a feeling of any kind. So no wonder we're not addressing these issues.
Sure. And I have to admit, when I first saw a show of your work, I was looking at it, and I think one of them was the 10,000 mail order catalogs, and I thought, well, that's nice he took a picture of that, but he's creating this giant mess now by pulling these together. But it's all a digital trick, accumulating, bring them all together. How do you do that? How do you, like, create an image of millions of things and then create out of that image sort of a recognizable figure made up of all those little tiny images?
Yeah, well, sometimes people think that what I do is I actually assemble that many, you know, a million plastic cups into something. And I would do that, but I don't have the patience. You know, take my entire life to do one piece. So what I do is I individually photograph lots of the individual items. You know, like I happen to have an artist friend who collected credit cards for years and years and years, and she had this huge box of credit cards. So I borrowed the box of credit cards from her, and I wanted to do a black and white image of the credit card. So I just chose all the black and the gray and the silver and white ones. And I think I individually photographed maybe 200 credit cards. And then it's not too difficult in Photoshop to then cut each one of those out from its background so that when you lay them on top of each other in Photoshop, it sort of looks like real credit cards laid on top of each other. And then it's just there are various – I use some computer programs. Some of them are made totally manually with just hundreds of thousands of drag and drop actions in Photoshop. It's just a matter of kind of slowly working my way across the canvas until I have an image.
I'd like to get to talk maybe about some of your more recent work that doesn't work on that theme. You had a chance to travel in Kenya, 1,000 miles in Kenya, where there's a group of non-government groups working with local people to create a sustainable way of life. And in looking at that gallery, it looks as though these are more straightforward photos. These are of what's going on. Is that right?
Yeah, that was for me is a very welcome return to the process of documentary photography. Because, you know, this series that I call Running the Numbers, which are these large-scale digital constructions, there's a kind of sterility to the process of creating them. It's very different from going out in the world with a camera. So it felt really good to go to Kenya and photograph again. And at the same time, the subject matter was just so moving to me. You know, on one hand, meeting these people who had never seen someone from my part of the world and who are living in such a different way than we are, like in this extremely deep connection with the land around them. And at the same time, to have the opportunity to stand over the carcass of a freshly killed elephant that had been killed for its tusks the previous night that we were there, and to be with the guys who were chasing these poachers. And to just experience that was it was kind of life-changing.
You've also done an amazing series of photographs that's of albatrosses that really illustrates the plastic in the oceans and what the plastic in the oceans do. And by the way, if you're listening to us and you want to see what Chris Jordan and I are talking about, it's chrisjordan.com. You can see these photos there. Could you describe like how you got onto that? This is in Wake Island?
It's near Wake Island.
Okay.
It's on Midway Island,
okay.
Which is one of the islands out there in the northwestern.
Way out there.
Yeah, it's the same distance from Honolulu. You fly straight out over the ocean, the same distance as from Vancouver, British Columbia to Tijuana. And if you look at it on Google Earth or on a map of the Pacific, it looks like this little tiny distance, but it's actually hours of flying over nothing but wide open ocean, and arriving on this tiny little island, Midway Island, the fabled Midway Island, where the Battle of Midway happened in World War II, and discovering that on this place, which is one of the remotest islands on our planet, are the dead, decaying carcasses of tens of thousands of dead baby albatrosses whose bodies are filled up with plastic from the Pacific garbage patch.
And they're stunning photos. The carcasses are surrounded, and they tend to be dark and muddy tones. And then in the middle, these brightly colored pieces of plastic where their stomachs are. Was that exactly the way you saw it? Did you kind of add them to increase the drama of the photo? Is that documentary in that sense?
Well, as soon as we went out there and started seeing these scenes that look like, you know, Salvador Dali paintings,
you know,
they're just so surreal, I immediately realized that people were going to question the veracity of the photographs. And I had seen pictures from Midway, before we went out there, there are quite a few pictures on the internet already of albatrosses filled with plastic on Midway Island, and I doubted their truth because they're just so bizarre. Mm-hmm. I mean, an entire handful, like a, you know, half a quart or three quarters of a quart of plastic bottle caps inside one baby bird's stomach. And so as soon as we got there, I got together with my team and I said, okay, this is going to be our practice around these birds, is nobody moves a single piece of plastic. We're not going to add any plastic. We're not going to arrange it. We're not going to manipulate it. To the point where sometimes we were setting up a photograph and my tripod leg would bump the bird and it would just shake the plastic around and rearrange it a little bit. And I'd say, mm-hmm. sorry, we can't take that picture. Because I wanted to be able to come back with a totally clear conscience that those were as straight documentary photographs as could be achieved.
Yeah. You said team, Chris Jordan. I imagine Chris Jordan out there with his tripod and his camera. You have a team.
Well, one of the things I also realized as we were beginning to make the plans to go out there is I sort of imagined coming back and being filled with regret that I didn't have a documentary film crew with me, not only to document the truth of what's happening out there, but also it just like the story of what's happening out on Midway just has this kind of epic quality to it. You know, like of all the birds in the world that could be sending us this profound message about the health of our world, you know, it could be the Laysan duck filled up with plastic or the northern fulmar or, you know, the blue-footed booby. But it's the albatross, you know, this magnificent creature that has this long history in our poetry and literature as a harbinger. And of all the places this story could be happening, you know, it could be happening on Tern Island or on Wake Island or on French Frigate Shoals, but it's on Midway, you know, and of all the islands, that thing, all the names that island could have, you know, that the island where this is happening could be called Coconut Atoll, you know, but it's Midway. And like what more evocative, powerful term to describe where humanity finds itself right now, as the old paradigms are in collapse and the new ones are beginning to merge. And it's like we're going through the eye of the needle right now. And so I began to think there's an epic story being told that's more than just lots of bird fields with plastic. And so I decided to bring a film crew. And since then, the project has turned into a vortex that's really absorbed my imagination and all my time and resources for 3 years now.
When will the documentary be coming out? I assume there will be a documentary.
Well, not exactly.
Yeah.
It's went back to the island a few more times, the story began to tell itself to us in a way that begs for something other than a standard documentary film. And it's just there's so much beauty and so much kind of lyrical grace in these birds, and they have no fear of humans. You know, these are birds that are as big as eagles, and you can literally go up so close. I can go up so close filming their babies hatching from their eggs that my forehead is bumping up against the mother's breast.
Wow.
And they have no fear of us. Mm-hmm. And so we've been able to capture footage that to me is different than a documentary film. It's sort of more like a kind of poetic story or an art offering or something like that.
Do you know what the final form will be? It sounds as though you're thinking about it right now.
Well, I'm imagining a film that might have a feel a little bit like Baraka or Anasquatsi, you know, like not a lot of words. But it also has this tragedy in it, you know, It's hard to define exactly how it's going to come out, and we're actually just at the beginning of editing, and so we don't exactly know what it's going to be yet. You know, we have the canvas in front of us and all of our paints. We have 16,000 shots we made out on the island, and I'm going to be sitting down over the next 9 months or so working with our editor and actually constructing what it's going to be, and we think it's going to come out about a year from now.
To be continued. We'll check in with you when it gets closer to its fruition. People might be surprised in hearing about your interests and what you do now to know that you were a corporate attorney for 10 years. I guess my question is, was that all just useless to what you do now? Or was there anything about being a corporate attorney that actually you find useful in your current pursuits?
I wouldn't say it was useless at all. I learned a lot about critical thinking and analysis. And in a sort of negative way, I learned about what it feels like to not be living my life. And because, You know, I knew lots of attorneys in the corporate world and just sort of in the Seattle attorney world who loved what they're doing. They were really good at it. And it just was never for me. Mm-hmm. And my heart wasn't in it. And it took me a decade of feeling this just kind of terrible feeling of fear and sadness and regret and at realizing that I just wasn't doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
But the way an attorney thinks has been useful to you going
Definitely.
Forward, the critical thinking, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of art of advocacy mm-hmm. is it feels powerful to me. And a lot of times people talk about me as an activist. I don't really think of myself as an activist, but they use terms that I would use in a courtroom about stating my case and giving evidence. And I'm like, they didn't even know I was a lawyer, but I sort of sound like one sometimes.
Yeah. Well, certainly some of the point of your photography and your artwork is to try to move the needle, is to try to create some more awareness and in some way move us forward towards the recognition of the ways that we are messing things up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you have? Can you step back from it and go, yeah, that's something that I did move the needle because of what I'm doing?
Well, it's an interesting question. It used to matter to me a lot to figure out, to try to measure if I'm making a difference. And I was sort of making that a prerequisite to keeping on working. Like, I'll only keep doing this if I know that I'm making a difference.
I get a bottle law passed or something.
That's one of the hardest things about doing the kind of activism that I'm doing, like trying to raise consciousness. There's a sort of ethereal aspect about it that's impossible to measure.
Sure.
And there's no way to ever know what would have the world been like if I didn't exist versus if I did, to measure if what I'm doing makes any difference. So I guess the way I've come to think of it is, there are hundreds of thousands of people who could all fall into the category of activists, whether it's teachers who are teaching new ways of thinking, or if it's documentary filmmakers making films, or poets or artists or radio talk show hosts who are all sort of aiming towards something. And I just feel like I'm aiming towards something as well, and hopefully I'm contributing something. And in the process, it's an amazing life as well.
We're just about out of time, but is this film that you're making about the albatrosses going to be the next year of your life? Are you working on any other photography projects right now?
Well, I would like to be working on other stuff, but the Midway project just is such a vortex that it's hard to. One thing I am doing, though, wow, this is the first time I've ever said this, is I'm writing a book that I'm hoping will be released around the same time of the film. It's going to give a lot of the background about the process and, the sort of transformation that's happened to me as a result of witnessing the tragedy and the beauty of Midway Island.
And you can see both of those things at chrisjordan.com, where he's got a gallery up of this work and his earlier work that we were just talking about. Chris Jordan, thank you so much for coming by. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for having me on, Ross.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.